This actually was going to be a team teach this morning with me and Joshua, but, you know, he wimped out on me. I was giving him a hard time because he's like, I don't think I'm going to be up for tomorrow. But see, 10 years ago, he would be like, he would be so sick on a Saturday night at like midnight. And he'd be texting me going, I'm doing terrible, but I should be fine in the morning. And I'm like, what are you thinking? So the fact that he knew, Karen and I were just commiserating over this very funny thing about Joshua. He always thinks he's going to heal like right away. And it's like, oh, sometimes you take a little bit of time. But yeah, so he is out this morning. So I'm going to be handling this one solo. So we're going to dive in this morning. Talk more about experiencing the Bible. We said, last week, the last 2 weeks, the Bible is one big story that points to Jesus. And we used Amber's very cool story map and talked through it. And we talked about how the story leads to Jesus. Now, I want to let you guys know, we're going to actually be teaching a Sunday school class, Amber and I together, in April. And to go through some of this more slowly, it'll be before service in one of these classrooms. So just keep that in mind. We're going to go deeper into this stuff because we think understanding the Bible is quite important and actually quite fun. So we hope you guys will join us on that. Keep that in mind. We'll talk more about it later. But now that we've talked about navigating the story, I want to talk a little bit about navigating the book itself, the Bible itself, which can be intimidating. I want to talk especially to those of you who are new to the scriptures, or maybe you've had, maybe you're young, or maybe you just had minimal experience with reading. Hopefully demystify some of it, and so hopefully the rest of you will get something out of this too. So remember, first of all, the Bible, I was supposed to have my Bible up here, but I forgot to bring it. The Bible is not really one book. It's more like a library of 66 books. And in that library, we have all different kind of books that are not in chronological order. So how does that work? Well, let me give you a really, really, can I give you a stupid analogy? I'm just going to. This right here, the Infinity Saga. All right, the Infinity Saga. This is one big epic story that many of you are familiar with. There were like 22 movies, I think, that made this thing up. And it all came together to tell one story about a homicidal maniac with really, really powerful rocks, okay? And how everyone was trying to stop him. Now, suppose you were to break down the Infinity Saga, even more than the 22 books. Some of you are like, I hate every single second of this. Just, I'll come back to reality in just a second. Suppose you broke down the Infinity Saga even more than the 22 books, or 22 movies, and you had like smaller movies or episodes or books. You might see books like this. The History of the Infinity Stones. Okay, probably quite boring, but you know, that would be there. First and Second Thanos. You might see The Prophecies of Doctor Strange. Strange apocalyptic Ezekiel type stuff right there. Hawkeye's Letters to His Children. Be very lovely. The Songs of Star-Lord. Tony Stark's Book of Snark. I mean, this would be the most read of all of them probably. And then Captain Marvel's Ridiculous Powers Explained, which still wouldn't make any sense. So that is a really, really dumb analogy, but it's kind of what we have with the Bible. We have lots of little books and all different types of literature, and they're all connected back to these characters in this big story, okay? So if you are, if you just opened your Bible to a table of contents, you would see stuff like this. You would see this, and the font would be very, very small. 66 books are broken down into Old and New Testament. Stop texting me, Joe Liebersbach. Goodness. I forgot to turn off my Wi-Fi. How could you? I love you. You complete me. If you opened the table of contents, this is what you would see. It's sort of grouped into genre, although interestingly enough, the groupings are different than they are in the Hebrew Bible. We're not going to go into that because this is just a quick overview. But you would see the breakdown would be sort of like this. In the Old Testament, you've got Genesis through Deuteronomy. That's the Torah, like the foundation story. Then we've got Joshua through Esther, which is the history of the nation of Israel. Job to Song of Solomon. There's a lot of poetry and wisdom in there. And Isaiah to Malachi. That's visions and sermons from the prophets. That's the way people who put together our English Bible did it. That's why they did it that way. In the New Testament, we've got Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the biographies of Jesus. Then we've got the book of Acts, which is the story of how the church began. And then Romans to Revelation, which is all letters from the apostles. Let me back up here. So they're roughly grouped by genre, but also by time, because you've got the early stuff in the beginning and the late stuff in the end, right? Now, maybe the Bible is new to you and you're wondering, okay, where do I start reading? Because this is intimidating. Personally, I would recommend this. Start with the book of Mark. Start with a biography of Jesus or Luke. Mark or Luke. Read the biographies of Jesus, then read through the New Testament, and then I would start with the Old. Personally, that's what I would say, since we're Jesus people, so just start with Jesus. But, you know, to each his own. Some people like to just go right from Genesis all the way through. That makes for some very tough sledding, I'm going to be honest with you. But whatever's working for you. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about translations. Okay? Bible translations. You probably, if you're like me, you have a lot of them. And you're always wondering, what's a good one to have like as my go-to? Well, I would say, here's why we have so many translations. Remember, the Bible was translated from three languages: Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek. And English translations are always wrestling with these languages and trying to communicate to us modern American readers, or wherever you might happen to be from. The reason there are so many versions is that this is incredibly difficult to do. Let me give you a quick primer and teach you two different terms that you're welcome to forget in about 2 minutes. But it might be helpful as we set this up. This comes from Mark Strauss's book, 40 Questions About Bible Translations. Historically, he said, there have been two main philosophical and methodological approaches to translation. Here's the first one. Formal equivalence, also known as word for word. And this seeks to reproduce the form of the source text as much as possible. Formal equivalence. But we also have this one, functional equivalence, also known as dynamic equivalence. Or it's meaning-based. It seeks to reproduce the meaning of the source text regardless of form. So we've got these two things, functional equivalence and formal. And there's a constant balance for translators in any language between these two poles. The reason is, if you get too literal in one language, then it's not going to make any sense in another language, right? Because there's so many idioms and sayings, it just stops making sense. But if you try to go just too broad and meaning-based, then you lose all the, like, you know, fidelity to the text itself. So it's a balance, and all of our Bible translations are on a continuum, sort of between those two poles. So let me show you what Strauss did, how he looked at these. We're not going to look at all of them, but if you started with the most famous, what's the most famous English Bible ever? King James Bible. You see that? That's going to be up here on this side, on the formal side, KJV, the King James Version. It's a more formal translation. It's beautiful, very poetic. And unless you really like Shakespeare, do not start with the King James Bible, because it's just, some of the language is very old and archaic, right? But it is beautiful. So if you're a literary nerd, you're like, oh, I want to read that. Great. Awesome. Have at it. But if you're a newbie, don't start there. It's going to be difficult. I would start, if you want a translation that's like more formal equivalence, I would recommend the New American Standard, the NASB. The NKJV is also a good one. I used to do the ESV a lot. But there's a lot of really kind of obvious translation biases that come out of that one, so I've backed away from it a bit. My personal favorite right now is the CSB, which is kind of right in the middle. It's a great balance. The Christian Standard Bible, a mix of formal and functional. So it's accurate and readable at the same time. The NIV is kind of similar. It also does that thing of balancing them pretty well. That probably leans more over into functional. But that's probably still the most read Bible in English today. But if you're looking for a highly readable, very functional translation that's as simple as you can get it, and still a good translation, I would recommend the NLT over on the form, the functional side. The NLT, the New Living Translation, that's a good one. The language is fluid, and it's comparatively easy to understand. So I'm not going into the rest of those, but I do want to highlight one other one. You'll see it in the bottom corner, MSG. What's that? Anybody know? The Message. Okay. You probably know by now, I am an unapologetic lover of The Message. I really am, truly. I think it's fantastic, but in my mind, it's not really a translation. Okay, it's more of a commentary. There's one man, Eugene Peterson, who did the whole thing by himself, which is never a good idea for an actual Bible translation because your biases come in. But he wasn't trying to do a translation. First of all, he was a stellar expert on the original languages. But what he was trying to do was to analyze for his congregation this idea. If this passage was written for my congregation today, in this century, what might it sound like? Okay, so he was taking all kinds of liberties and going extreme functional equivalents. Does that make sense? So he actually didn't want it to be a Bible. It was his publisher came along and said, we really want this to be a Bible, and he fought it, but finally agreed to it. So I still love it. We use it here sometimes on passages that are already very familiar to most of us because it's a great way to shake us up. I use it as a commentary. When I'm reading through a Bible and go like, man, I wonder what that means. Like, oh, I wonder what Peterson says, how he translates it. And it's wonderful used that way or as devotional literature. One other translation, I just want to say it's not up here. Most of these kinds of analysis don't have this one in there because honestly, it's just not a good translation and I heartily do not recommend it, and it's the Passion Translation. I know I can hear your hearts breaking in here. I'm sorry. I wish I could recommend this one, but honestly, it's just not an accurate translation at all. It would be the least accurate of all of these. It was translated also by one person who really wasn't very qualified to do it. And my biggest problem with it is that there's just a lot of stuff that's not in the original languages. He just adds a lot. And sometimes he adds stuff that I go, oh, I really like that because I happen to agree with it. Because I'm in his target audience as someone who believes in the activity of the Holy Spirit and things like this. The problem is he's putting stuff in there that's just not in the Bible. It's just not there. So therefore, as someone who's trying to be faithful to the text, I just can't recommend that one. I have other problems with it too, but I don't want to break hearts any further than I am. I love you guys. You can still use this to me. I'm like, well, you can use it however you want to. I'm not your dad. But you could use it sort of like, you know, as devotional literature or as a commentary itself. Just know that it's not a very accurate Bible. The Passion Translation. Yeah, thank you, Dave Crimes. I might be talking kind of fast this morning. I do that sometimes. But just for you, I want to make sure that you're awake, you're tracking. All right. I want to talk a little about genre now, okay? We have lots of movie references today. Call out some genres as you see a movie cover. What genre would this be? Action. What about this one? Romance. What about this one? Sci-fi. Comedy. Schindler's List. Drama. Musical, right? Now, we know this. We don't have to think much about it because we already have genre in our head and what a genre means. So if you're watching something like Nacho Libre, for example, which is probably one of the finest pieces of art in the past century, you will know that when Nacho is in the ring and he gets hit really, really hard, he's going to be fine. Like, he's okay, you know? Because this is the nature of a slapstick comedy. You're going to get hit on the head by stuff or with an arrow or all kinds of stuff, you know, be thrown out of the ring, and he's going to pop up and be just fine. It's like the Three Stooges. You understand that's how the genre works. For me, when I was a kid, I did not understand the genre of musical. So it annoyed me so much because I'd be like, they never practiced that song, you know? So, and people roll their eyes. I'm like, well, they wouldn't. How they're doing this perfect dance routine. Well, I didn't understand the genre of musical. And one of the rules in musical is expect a whole bunch of impromptu singing and dancing and do not ask questions, right? So we have these kinds of understandings. I could go for a long time on the things we innately understand about genre in movies, but the Bible has a bunch of genres as well. And getting just a couple of handles on some of these things, I think might help us. Now, I wanna tell you, man, oh man, you guys, this is a very, very, very quick overview on this stuff. Some break it down like this. You have narrative, wisdom, poetry, prophecy, gospels, epistles, and apocalypse. I'm not gonna look at Amber because I know she's just cringing right now. This is too much of a breakdown for me and for what we're doing. Tim Mackey actually breaks it down in one of his videos this way. He says, narrative, discourse, and poetry. So I wanna look at this, narrative, discourse, and poetry. Now, if you wanna go deeper in this, I have a couple of QR codes. Actually, these are great for just a basic how to study the Bible thing. Anyway, so on the left is the Bible Project series on how to read the Bible. It's a whole series of like 5-minute videos. I think it takes maybe close to an hour if you watch all of them, but they're wonderful. They're really, really great. And on the right is a book I would recommend called How to Read the Bible for All It's Worth by a scholar named Gordon Fee. And he goes into genre and he goes into, gives all these wonderful handles on the best way to understand different genres of scripture and beyond. So both wonderful resources. I'll leave those up for a couple of minutes as we talk about this. Let's talk about narrative. Let's start there. Narrative. More than 40% of the Bible is narrative. It's like a story, right? It's a drama. There's stuff happening. Fencing, fighting, torture, revenge, giants, monsters, chases, escapes, true love, miracles. It's my third movie reference today. Is this a kissing book, Carly asks. Song of Solomon is indeed a kissing book, Carly. There's the nature of genre is that stuff happens. You know, this happened, and then the next thing happens. The thing is, there's not always commentary on why it happens or whether it was good. Do you remember Aesop's Fables? You would read it like the tortoise and the hare, you know, and you get to the end, and you had this great little thing at the bottom of the page, and it said, moral of the story. Slow and steady wins the race. Oh, okay, that's what I'm supposed to learn. The Bible won't do that. It's funny, because people talk about Bible stories being like moralistic tales, but they don't, they almost never tell you whether something happened was good or bad. Isn't that interesting? So you, occasionally it does, sometimes it does. You know, the narrator will step in and say what David did with Bathsheba and Uriah and all that stuff was wicked in the sight of the Lord. And you're like, oh good, I thought it was just me, you know? But it doesn't give you that all that often. Now, so what we have to do is learn to read it and to question and not get too worked up. So we looked at Jacob, for example. He's got four wives. And he's not a good father. Like, you're like, is this a good dude even? Like, what is this? And what's the deal with having four wives? Look what the Bible teaches. And what we need to do is step back and say, wait a minute. Is this descriptive or prescriptive? Is this telling us the way we're supposed to do something? Or is it just telling us the way somebody did something? You with me? Really, really good question to ask. Most of the time, it's going to be descriptive. The narratives in scripture, they're more like newspaper articles than they are opinion pieces. I know those things get mixed together now, big time. But they're much more like articles, just giving you the news. So we have to read the Bible like grown-ups. And that's good, because most of us in here are grown-ups. We have to read it and be okay to wrestle with it without having an immediate moral of the story. So if you are reading, say, the book of Judges, and you see the story of Samson, and Samson's supposed to be this hero, right? We know the pillars, and yeah, and you're like, wait a minute, Samson just hired a prostitute, and then the Philistines, and then he just keeps doing the dumbest things imaginable. Like, is this even a good dude? Is this a smart dude? Because he seems like a massive moron. Agreed, he totally was. So then you're asking like, well, why did God choose him? Wait, and at that point, I would say, friends, we're getting it. Wrestling with the text. Why indeed would God choose someone like that? This is what narrative does. It draws us in. It forces us to ask questions. This is what good stories do. This is why we like movies so much, because good stories pull us in and make us uncomfortable and make us ask questions and dig deeper. That's narrative. It's generally, to me, the most fun of all the genres. Let's look at the next one, discourse. Discourse. This would include things like portions of the Torah, wisdom literature, the epistles. In this genre, somebody is speaking to someone else for some reason, and we get to listen in. It's meant to be persuasive, and it's much more literal, and it's lighter on metaphor than poetry, which we'll talk about after this. But we have to be really careful how we apply it. Let me give you an example. The most famous book of discourses in the Old Testament would be the book of Proverbs. And Proverbs, it'll give you something like this. Don't answer a fool according to his foolishness, or you'll be like him yourself. That's good, huh? Look at the next verse. Answer a fool according to his foolishness, or he'll become wise in his own eyes. Wait, what? What am I supposed to do? Like, if you're wondering, well, those seem contradictory. Yeah, they totally are. He's giving you two different scenarios. What he's not trying to do is give you the answers in the back of the book that will set you sailing for life. You know what I'm saying? This is wisdom literature. We are meant to wrestle with it. So when you see something like this, you're like, oh man, this could be two different things. I wonder where I am today. I wonder which proverb is going to help me deal with this very difficult person that's in my life. You know what I'm saying? We're supposed to wrestle with it. But if we start treating these like guarantees, like you do this and boom, I promise you'll be blessed in these ways and everything's going to be great for you, you're going to miss the boat entirely. And in fact, your faith could end up being totally shipwrecked if you start treating it that way. There's verses, for example, that say, you know, my son, forget not my law, but let your heart keep my commandments, for length of days and long life and peace will they add to thee. Memorized that in the King James when I was a kid, you remember? But if you're taking this as a guarantee, then according to that, no kids should die. People should never die young unless, well, I guess I should have listened to the commands of the Lord, otherwise they wouldn't have died young. You see what I'm saying? We could end up looking at things and be drawing all kinds of strange conclusions. This is wisdom literature, so let's read it for wisdom and not think that there's somehow guarantees with every verse that are going to lead to a good outcome. It's sort of like the Proverbs to me are sort of like this. It's like your driver's ed teacher going, hey, if you want to stay alive, maybe don't speed. Like stop going 60 miles an hour through Junction City. Sorry, too soon. Like don't do that. He's not guaranteeing that if you don't speed, you'll never get into a car accident, but he's giving us wisdom. So that's, I probably lean a little too heavily there into the Proverbs alone, and I got off my notes. Sorry. But that's something to keep in mind. It's not giving us direct answers most of the time. It's giving us wisdom. Now, sometimes this gets really complicated. Like the biggest hurdle in reading biblical discourse is usually the fact that we don't at first know the culture or the customs or the language or the religion that we're dealing with. So we don't get the context of the argument. What we need to do is just understand that. Understand we're coming in sort of as tourists. I went on a missions trip to Thailand when I was 16 years old, and we had to get a long talk sort of just so we knew what to do culturally and what not to do. They told us this one thing that I've never forgotten. They're like, make sure you don't show people the bottom of your feet ever. I was like, what? They're like, oh yeah, that's like flipping somebody the bird, only way worse. And I thought, man, that's so weird. But I wonder when people come to America, they're like, hey, you know how we wave to each other with our middle fingers at home? Don't do that. This is culture, right? This is culture. There's all kinds of cultural things that we don't get. This is true for narrative as well. And so what do we need then? We need some help in this arena. We need some help. We need to consult people who know the culture. But here's the great thing. The church has been diving into these issues for 2,000 years. Don't try to read the Bible alone, you know? I mean, we have devotional reading, obviously. But don't try to understand it alone. Why would we possibly want to do that when we have scholars that have been studying this for a very long time and continue to do so? Get teachers in your life. Now, this is one of the joys that I get and that we get, because that's part of our job, is to help you guys understand. So if you're wrestling with something, come talk to us and we'll try to give you more tools. It's one of my favorite things, is to try to understand these kinds of points of context. But, you know, you can read, you can go deeper. I would always recommend Bible Project videos if you're trying to understand any of this kind of thing, because it's very rich and so accessible. But there are commentaries and Bible dictionaries that are easy to incorporate that can help inform you of the context of what you're reading. Okay? Are we good there? I said, are we good there? Like, no. I have a million questions, but I'm like, I can't. I got to keep going. Okay, I'm going to skip over to one more. There's so much more to say there, but I don't have time. Whoops. Poetry. The genre of poetry. You could include the prophetic books in here, apocalyptic literature, but the main ones we think of when we hear poetry is Psalms. The Psalms. Yeah, the Psalms are so, so rich. Many of us probably end up reading the Psalms almost every time we open our Bibles when we're doing devotionals or all kinds of stuff. It is my personal favorite book of the Bible. I absolutely love it. And it's full of figurative language. People will sometimes ask, is the Bible literal? And it's like, I'm saying, what part? What are you reading? If you're reading, like, you know, smoke came from the nose of God, and like, he there's this one chapter he talks about, he rides on the back of the cherubim. And to me, I like think of like Gandalf and Shadowfax, you know? I'm like, that's so cool, but it's like, yeah, don't draw theology from that. He's clearly showing this picture of God as a warrior and God being roused to action, right? Metaphor. It speaks the language of metaphor all the way through. Therefore, we have to be careful about trying to make theology from the Psalms. We just have to be careful because we can very easily get off into all kinds of silliness and even start our own cults. Was that too dark? Is that too... Don't do that thing, just so we're clear. The moral of the story, kids, is don't. Okay. So the Psalms are written by some by David, some by people in the tradition of David, some by various Levites throughout the years. And the thing I love about the Psalms is that they welcome every kind of emotion, every kind of prayer. For example, excitement. You've got, let the whole earth shout triumphantly to the Lord. You've got fear. Be gracious to me, O Lord, for I am weak. Heal me, for my bones are shaking. My whole being is shaken with terror. And you, Lord, how long? Turn, rescue me. That's a prayer that somebody prayed that's recorded in the Psalms. We've got regret. God, create a clean heart for me and renew a steadfast spirit within me. We've got thanksgiving. My soul, bless the Lord and all that is within me. Bless his holy name. We even get Psalms with rage. The wicked are estranged from the womb. Those who speak go astray from birth. O God, shatter their teeth in their mouth. Break out the fangs of the young lions, O Lord. Is anyone uncomfortable with that? Because I am. There are several psalms like this, and this is one of the tamer ones. These are often called imprecatory psalms that are like uncomfortable, you know? And the question is, are we supposed to pray that? I would say I don't think that's why it's here. I don't think it's saying here's a good thing to pray. I think God is telling us, bring all of it to God. Bring all of it. Don't actually go and break somebody's teeth. But if you've got that, come to the Lord, tell him what's in your heart. He knows anyway. He might need to correct you and go, hey, don't do that. Bring it all. It's all safe with God. Isn't that a beautiful thing? God's not intimidated by your anger. So thankful for that. The Psalms teach us how to give full voice to the Lord without holding back, knowing it's him that we want to direct, that we need to direct us and correct us. It's an invitation to talk with him without editing ourselves. Now, as you can see, I really love the Bible very much, but it's undeniably complicated, and sometimes you're going to run into some stuff that's a little troubling. And I just want to tell you that stuff ahead of time if you've never run into it, so that you're not surprised by it. And I want to tell you that the church is well aware of these passages and has been for a long time. So don't be intimidated when somebody puts up a meme with something like, do Christians even know this verse is in here? We're like, yeah, theologians have been arguing this for 1,800 years, bro. Like, don't be intimidated by that stuff. It's silly. It's silly. It's cheap internet culture. But also, I want to say this. Some of those questions are easily answered. Some of them are tricky. And I don't have answers for, and I still wonder what to do with it. But the reason I don't let troubling passages, especially those violent ones, pull me away from reading the scriptures is because of Jesus himself. Look what Jesus says. This is Jesus. You have heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. That's what Jesus says. Love your enemies. I know I told this recently, but it's worth repeating. I had an old student who pushed back on me when I started talking about loving your enemies one day on Facebook. And he got mad at me. He says, it's almost like you forgot about King David and how he crushed his enemies. And I said, brother, we're not Davidians. We are Christians. You see that? He's telling us what to do. Did David maybe hate his enemies? Well, yeah, it seems like he kind of did sometimes. Well, Jesus is telling him, hey, guys, love your enemies. Jeez, it's the example and the call of Jesus that we stand on. And for me, that helps me to go, you know what? I don't understand all of this stuff, but here's the heart of Jesus. He's really, really good. And it's on the benefit of him, of who he is, that God came in human form to lay down his life and die for us, that I can go, I can still wrestle with this and trust you. I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt on some of these hard things that I haven't figured out yet. Because you are so good, and your story is so powerful and beautiful and clear. I'm not going to let the things that are not clear suddenly cloud that image. He is the center. The story points to him. Are you with me? And he's really, really good. He's got this too. Whoops. Lord, said Philip, show us the Father, and that's enough for us. And Jesus said, have I been among you all this time, and you don't know me, Philip? The one who has sent me has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father? He's the one who has seen me, has seen the Father. You see that? Jesus says, I look like him. So if you're wondering what God's actually like, look at me. I don't know about you, but I really like that a lot because I like Jesus. You've also got this. Whoop, this one which I forgot to paste into my slideshow. We've got this, Matthew 5:9, blessed are the peacemakers, for they are called sons of God. Blessed are the peacemakers, says Jesus Christ of Nazareth. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called sons of God. This is who we are called to be as peacemakers. So there's a lot I don't understand, but I am so drawn and captivated by Jesus of Nazareth. And that spurs me on to want to understand at a deeper level all that came before and all the context given to that story. Because I want to know him even deeper. But I hold on through not understanding some things. And one day, I'm sure he's going to show me all the stuff. I look forward to that day. I look forward to that. But you know who we need right now? We need that peacemaker. We need Jesus. Especially this weekend. I don't think I probably have to tell anybody what's going on in the world right now. It's been a rough weekend. The world's in turmoil, and none of us knows what's going to happen. There's war in the Middle East, and nobody knows what's going to happen. And this is the time for us not to have a panel on what we think is wise to do politically. This is time for us as the family of God to pray for peace. This is our call. And this morning we're going to do that. But at the risk of nepotism, I'm going to do something else first. I'm going to read something that my son Jack just wrote this morning. I asked if I could share it, and he said I could. I won't tell Jack's story now. Suffice it to say, he doesn't speak, but the dude writes. And he wrote this on the keyboard this morning. Hello, dear ones. Let me speak about peace in the midst of turmoil as we hold our breath and wonder how the God of Shalom, a peace that brings healing to our hurting hearts, will possibly show up in the midst of our very real and present chaos. If a powerful and good God exists, where is he when evil takes over and war breaks out and innocent lives are destroyed? He is right there, walking through the chaos with us, holding bleeding hearts and bruised spirits in the midst of our agony, breathing his deep shalom even as his own tears stream to wash our torn and battle-worn hearts. Before us, behind us, beside us, and within us, he meets us with his tender presence if we allow him. He creates a garden space in our hearts where we can still flourish, whether surrounded by desert or wild chaos. He is where heaven overtakes earth, not in the removal of chaos or the ceasing of strife, but in his presence, creating resurrected gardens in us in the midst. I, like most of us, suspect, have wished he would either stop the chaos or pluck me from it. But his peace is far deeper than the absence of chaos or removal from life. He is after our hearts. And his deepest desire is to connect with us there in our joy and our pain and plant heaven there. This is his plan for bringing heaven on earth. So as we pray for peace on earth, let it begin in us today. Let us open our hurting and terrified and angry hearts to his gentle tears that water our thirsty hearts and soften the soil so it's ready to receive seeds of his kingdom and flourish as a luscious green space overflowing with his presence and radiating shalom to our surroundings. Bring peace on earth, O God. Let it begin in me.